Okay. We have a very precarious mic situation, but hopefully it'll hold. I love being tech support and construction. This is going to be awesome. You guys.
Hey, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast about business, technology, and culture, where we are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
This week, the host of the True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything, Adam Conover. It's actually a great interview, if I say so myself. He's freaking totally spot on.
Love it. Yeah. He is so smart, yeah. And he is fighting the good fight when it comes to truth and knowledge.
Yeah. Same.
But first... We begin with the news fix.
We do. We're going to do something new this week, right? We're trying a little new thing?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. We're just bringing in, we each get one thing. We each get one precious little jewel.
Okay.
But since I'm a Gemini, I brought two. I can't.
I'm a Libra, so I don't even know what that means.
So you followed the rules? I don't know. You think it should be more fair?
Oh,
I don't really know.
No, I'm fine with you having
really
two.
Know.
What you want to go first? How about you go, then I go,
please.
Then you no. You got two, right? So you go, I go, you go.
But okay, well, one of my things is just a quick follow-up, which is that I would like everyone to go on and read. I tweeted it. It is at newsroom.fb.com. Facebook. Its staff got back to us with an answer on why and how it follows people across the web who are not logged into Facebook and who do not have Facebook accounts. And I am recommending it primarily because it is a very important thing for web users to know. I don't think anybody realizes at this point how many third parties are following them all over the internet. Mm-hmm. And this post sort of, I mean, this post essentially says like, everyone is doing it. Which is true. And so you should go and read
malevolent.
It. Exactly. Mm. And then you should install a little web plugin called Disconnect, which blocks third-party trackers who want to follow you over the internet.
Wait, is that like a Chrome plugin or a browser plugin?
It's a browser plugin. You can get it for Firefox, Chrome, and I think Internet Explorer. I will warn you that some websites will perceive it as an ad blocker, which I find ironic. And then you can click on the little D at the top of your browser and see like the page you're on blocked 700 different social and analytic and contact requests.
Oh,
and it'll just make you hate the web. Yeah.
Wow.
But so go read it. The staff got back to us.
Wow. Good for them. That's great. You got to figure they've got a zillion people now on the be responsive section of their enterprise and workforce, right?
They have actually, and I wonder if this is like the unintended consequences that they're just going to tip over into publisher at this point because they've launched it as a series. It's a special series from Facebook called Hard Questions.
Wow.
That addresses the impact of our products on society. I know. I'm like, wait, did you accidentally just become a news publisher? Just saying. Uh-oh. Look out.
That's a whole different thing. Wow, that's fascinating.
I'll be following that series.
All right, my turn.
Yep, your turn.
Okay, so this came to me via the presidential Twitter feed, except in a very ingenious way. So about a year or so ago, I subscribed to the Twitter feed of this bot called Real Press Sec Bot. It's RealPressSecBot. Real Press Sec Bot. And it takes all of President Trump's tweets and it formats them like their official White House press releases, which A, I love, but B, is also factually correct because White House spokespeople dating back to Sean Spicer have said, yes, of course, presidential tweets are White House official policy. So there's that. There was one the other day that Monday, in which the president said, and this is a quote, Russia and China are currently playing the devaluation game as the U.S. keeps raising interest rates. Not acceptable. So there's a couple of things that are wrong with that. Number one is, and I've said this before, the president of the United States is economically uninformed, right? What happens when the Fed raises interest rates is that the United States dollar becomes more attractive as an investment, right? You get better interest rates here with American dollars, and thus other countries' currencies will naturally become less valuable. That's the way global economics works. Again, a thing that the president does not always have a firm grasp on. But more to the point, it's just not true that the Russians and the Chinese are devaluing their currency. And that is something I fixated on, as is the premise of this little segment we're doing in the news fix, because it made me bananas. It made me bananas. Yeah. He says it, and nobody challenges him, and arg. And that's it. And I just want to say that on the record.
I will say that I have tried to dig into the current manipulation situation with respect to Chinese currency.
That was very
Thank you. That was fun to say.
Yeah.
I want to make like a little rap song. P.S.
Yes.
Can we just take a moment to appreciate that Kendrick Lamar won a Pulitzer?
I know.
I mean, there are things happening in America that I love right now, and that is one of them.
Do you suppose the Pulitzer jury just said, 75 years of jazz and classical, the hell with it, let's pick Kendrick. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Don't ruin it for me.
I kind of do.
I mean, I do think that's probably true. Yeah. There's always like the makeup aspect, and then there's the, but then there, you know, man's a damn poet.
But I think it's cool. I think it's awesome. And, you know, you take that with Beyonce at Coachella last night or two nights ago, whatever it was. And I think it's awesome. I think it's really cool.
It is. Another great tweet, just as long as we're on culture for like a nanosecond. Yeah. The other day said, every time that you're feeling, you know, kind of down about yourself or uncertain, or you feel like people don't like you, just remember that there are people out there who hate Beyonce.
Wow.
And the tweet was like, there are people out there who hate perfection. So just like ruminate on that and then go on with your life.
Wow. I mean, I'm no huge Beyonce fan, right? Just music.
Right.
That's not my kind of music, but her entrepreneurship and her enterprise and her drive and the fact that she is just a hell of a businesswoman is kind of amazing.
It is remarkable. Anyway, it was a really funny tweet.
I was quoting you, by the way, hella. That's the thing you say all the time.
I know.
I'm spending too much time with you, Molly Wood.
I was going to say, I'm so glad that my extreme classiness is rubbing
off on you.
What's
great? You know you've done something that's going to make people chuckle when your producer has to duck down behind the control panel so she's laughing so hard that you can't see her.
Because
oh, man.
Kai said
hella.
Okay, but wait. To this question of the currency manipulation,
yes.
I didn't even know Russia was in that conversation with respect to currency manipulation. And then China, like, maybe is or maybe isn't.
China's not. China's been letting its currency appreciate in value for years now, and the president refuses to acknowledge that. The ruble is, in fact, plunging in value because of the sanctions on the oligarchs from 10 days, 2 weeks ago. It's nothing to do with the Fed and interest rates in this case. Sorry.
So, and is the president also, is he mad about interest rates? Because then I saw a whole thing that could it be perceived as a challenge on the independence of the Federal Reserve, which was a whole other set of things I did not know about.
Well, right. So generally speaking, you want the Fed to be independent from political pressure, right? Because you want the Fed to think about the economy and not what politicians want to happen with the economy. And what's going to happen to the president now and members of Congress is that going into the 2018 election cycle, we're going to be in a rising interest rate environment. Rising interest rates do a whole bunch of things, one of which is make money more expensive, which can tend to slow down an economic recovery, which we are in right now. And that will be problematic for the politicians trying to get reelected.
Mm-hmm.
Cha-cha-cha.
Yes. Plus housing.
I'm
just going to throw it out there now. I'm obsessed with I think the housing situation is so much more serious than we even realize.
The lack of affordable housing,
affordable housing, the sort of looming housing crisis. There have been all these little warning signs like they talked about like Home Depot's earnings plunging could be a sign of a housing crisis and all this stuff. And then our great story on evictions that the Morning Report did and all these unreported evictions, of which I am one as recently as December.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, it's all of a piece. All right. So the premise of today's News Fix is we're each going to bring one thing that we are fixated on. And in this case, it is this amazing presidential
tweet.
It's
the fixation.
Oh, look at you.
Actually, it's the fixation fix, but, you know, that's what it is.
The fixation fix.
Yep.
That could really be a band name.
Did that all by my lonesome.
And it turns out that we both brought a thing which is fundamentally about, is this even, what is real?
Yeah.
what is real? Which is also what our Adam Conover interview is about. But so the thing that I brought that I am fixated on is a study out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison finding that basically the vast majority of political ads about divisive issues that ran on Facebook before the 2016 U.S. presidential election were sponsored by, quote, suspicious groups. One in six of those were Russian, and the rest of them just had no publicly available information about them. This is based on a database of 5 million Facebook ads. Now, we know that just the 100,000 or so that were actively purchased or found to have been purchased by Russian bots or Russian actors, rather, reached millions of people. But so this is, you know, 122 groups labeled suspicious. Their identities are still unknown. And the survey calls it sort of an indication of the influence of this like AstroTurf or shell companies in U.S. politics. Only a quarter of them mentioned candidates specifically. 9% expressly advocated for or against individual candidates. And the others were really just all about divisive issues like guns, immigration, and race relations. And people are still telling me that they're not influenced by what they see on Facebook.
That's literally what I was just going to say. Yeah.
Yeah. And yet. And yet. Yes. I think like people don't even, and as every poll I hear about, you know, what do Republicans think about the Mueller investigation versus Democrats? What does this, you know?
Well,
it all comes down to the information you are consuming at this point.
Right. And thus we have a different perception of reality depending on so many, many things, but one of which is political persuasion and what news you choose to believe. That's truly.
Yep.
Let us know what you think about this or whatever you happen to be fixated on, actually. Just tweet at us. I'm at Kai Ryssdal. Molly is at Molly Wood. You can get to us on email as well, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or just plain old makemesmart.org and post right there. But there's so much going on.
So many ways. So many ways to get in touch with us. So, and we need your help to, you know, make it smart, make us smart, make everybody else smarter. Fix the fixation? I don't know. Now I'm pushing it.
Yeah, right.
Coming up, a conversation with Adam Conover about our craving for real knowledge.
So, Adam Conover, the host of the True TV show Adam Ruins Everything, it is... trying to honestly do the same thing we're doing, which is get people smart. Here's a little clip from Adam Ruins Everything. It's called Adam Ruins Going Green, about the false promise of electric cars. Here you go.
According to one study, even if a third of all drivers switch to electric cars, the carbon savings could be tiny.
But that's just right now. Soon all electricity will come from solar, wind, water, and heart. Go planet!
Yeah, but that dream is a long way off. And in the meantime, you're going to be pumping out a ton of CO2 from everything that goes into just making the car.
I love this guy. Mm-hmm. I love that show. You're going to hear a little more, I believe, about that episode and the fallout from it. But he also, Adam also does something that we like to do here at Make Me Smart. It's basically like we're a match made in heaven. He gets experts on. I'm telling you, I discovered the show completely randomly, and then it turned out that one of our producers, Shara Morris, works on both shows, like also works, and I lost my ever-loving mind. He brings in experts in various fields to help further the arguments that he's making about a particular subject, which, you know, helps make the case. But Adam is a comedian, not a journalist. So when we brought him in, we asked him about that and that decision to sort of bring these authority figures onto the show.
Well, Adam Ruins Everything is, I call, an informational sketch comedy show. And we, the sort of simple version of the show is that we dispel common misconceptions and or tell you the awful truth about everything that you take for granted. I sort of felt that when I was developing the show, I mean, I'm a very curious person. I've been an information sponge my whole life. I've listened to, you know, I've been an NPR listener. I listen to podcasts. I read articles, you know, et cetera. And so I've always sort of collected facts and information. But at the end of the day, I'm just a comic. And I knew that, you know, there's a limit to how credible I'm going to be. We put our sources in the top of the screen so people know we've done our research. But at the end of the day, like, okay, buddy, why should I listen to you? And that at that moment, we bring in, someone who actually knows. We try to get the person who has, you know, really done the original research on the topic. And, of course, we do a little bit of comedy with them as well. But we sort of give them the final point of the segment.
But what's kind of interesting to me is that the show premise works and also worked. It launched or premiered in 2015, but you're addressing common misperceptions, which suggests that, you know, the era of alternative facts is not new. I mean,
alone, they've just been weaponized, right?
They've been weaponized, but this is clear. There was clearly a wealth of material for you to draw from even before the current environment.
Absolutely. I mean, when we talk about what the phrase alternative facts refers to, right? That refers to, you know, people who say, well, there is a, you know, professional journalist consensus about an issue, but I'm ignoring that and providing my own facts, right?
Right.
But even before that state of affairs happened, you know, occasionally the professional journalist or media narrative would also be incorrect about something. There'd be sort of like a notion about in the public overall that was the consensus sort of reality notion that was not true, you know, and that's what we sort of that is sort of the main focus of our show is what do we have a broad cultural understanding of that is incorrect?
Do you ever feel in the, let's, how to say this, in the alternative fact universe in which we live?
Sure.
You ever feel like you're spitting into the wind?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, sometimes the spit gets on me, and I'm like, ugh, you know.
It's a big loogie, man.
Yeah, like, oh. I look at my Twitter mentions, and I'm like, whoa, this one got all over me. Yeah. But my real belief about the show is that for all the press that fake news, alternative facts, and that sort of thing gets, people really have a craving for real information and for real knowledge. People genuinely love to learn, and that's universal and nonpartisan. And any success our show has been because it fulfills that need for people. And when we approach topics with good faith, right, and say, well, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, and here are the questions that we have, and, you know, we give provisos, here's an expert, here's all our sources, mm-hmm. people respond to that really well. And there's that, you know, 10% who say, you know, oh, you didn't say exactly what, you didn't confirm my priors, you didn't say exactly what I wanted you to say, so I'm pissed at you. We do get those people, but we get a lot of people who say, oh, you changed my mind on this, or, you know, wow, thanks for bringing light to this. It, mm-hmm. it really does work.
Hmm.
I want to know what are some topics that got spit on you, but maybe we should stick to
that's a good one.
It's always surprising what topics turn out to be controversial. Like, we did an episode on the overall topic of going green, the idea of that through individual choice, we can, you know, save the planet if we just buy better stuff, right? And if we are, you know, if each of us conserves a little bit and buys better stuff, that'll save the planet, right? And that's not true. It actually takes, like, systemic, top-down, society-based change, right? So one of our examples for that was we talked about electric cars, and we talked about how, oh, everyone thinks that electric cars are going to save the world, but in fact, if you buy an electric car too often, if you, for instance, replace your perfectly good Prius with an electric car, because of all the emissions that go into making the car, the embodied emissions, you actually are increasing your carbon footprint thereby, right? The efficiency of the car's engine doesn't matter as much as the manufacturing overall.
But climate change isn't real, man.
So
that goes to the whole confirming the priors and deeply divided sets of reality in this country.
But here's the interesting thing. That is the response I thought we would get. I thought we would get the people saying climate change isn't real. We actually got almost none of that. The angry people were the angry Tesla fans who believed so strongly in their vision of, no, I, by buying this cool car, am changing the world. Elon says so, and you can't tell me that's not true. And we had our, you know, people wrote long rebuttals to our segment that mostly misunderstood it. Maybe, you know, I sort of think, hey, maybe we could have presented, you know, a little bit better. You know, I always look for what we could have done better. But it was really surprising how much that we got pushback from fans of the brand, right?
Right. Well, aside from the reactionary brand-loving liberal negative responses, which I think we can agree is a thing, can you think of a time when you really, like, got a piece of feedback or felt like you actually changed some minds?
Good question.
Because that's what we're all trying to do here.
Yeah. Where the feedback said that we had changed some minds specifically. I mean, I hear it when I go do live shows, when I tour. You know, people tell me, you know, what they like about the show. And my favorite thing that people say is, hey, I didn't circumcise my kid because of your show. Right. Because we did a segment on the history of circumcision in America and how, not talking about religious circumcision, but the habitual rest of circumcision. There's no reason to do it. And we do it because the inventor of cornflakes was trying to stop kids from masturbating, which is true. And, you know,
you heard it here, folks.
Well, you can go watch our segment.
Didn't
if you're
think you were coming to this podcast for that, did you?
but
I did.
But, you know, people when people say that to me, I'm like, man, that is a nice impact, because we had impact on some little boy's life, you know, with that segment. Or I didn't buy an engagement ring because of your segment, that kind of thing. You know, that's when we really know that it works.
When do you know it doesn't work?
I mean, there is, at the end of the day, you know, when we first started doing the show, I was like, yeah, man, we're changing the world. Holy, yeah, all right, we're going to, like, all these practices that are based on malarkey, like, I'm going out there, I'm fighting the good fight. And then after doing it for about a year, I was like, people are going to keep buying engagement rings overall, though. You know, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to, mass incarceration is not going to end because we did a show about it. That was a little bit of a crestfallen moment when I realized that, when, you know, I realized were the limits of our power. But, you know, our, the reason we do it is still that individual person who watches the show.
Right.
And I'm like, if we can open their minds to an issue to just a little bit, and even failing that, make them, you know, a little bit more curious and a little bit more critical of the information that they hear, then that's, that is to me the point of the show. And it's nice to make a living talking about stories that we care about and making jokes. So,
Yeah. Well, one thing that really surprised me was to discover that the show was not necessarily intended for kids. I watch it with my 11-year-old, who probably now knows like too much about circumcision.
I love that.
Can you ever really? But I feel like if you're going to start with changing minds and creating questioners, sort of why not aim it at kids? Or are you just sort of happy to have anybody who comes along and gets smarter, if you will?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, we didn't anticipate that the show would have so many kid fans when we made it. You know, like I got started at a website called College Humor, where we made the original series, and then we went on True TV. We're airing at 10 p.m. And so I was like, all right, we're making a comedy show for adults. We're making a show that I want to see. And about midway through the first season, people started tweeting at me saying, like, here's a picture of me and my kid watching the show. My 8-year-old is a real fan. Look, they're dressing up as you for Halloween kind of stuff. And ooh. I was like, oh my God, that's wonderful. But we have shows about sex and death coming up. And I started to get really afraid that we would get a backlash once we got to that heavier material. And thank goodness we didn't. You know, at the end of the day, I think people are happy to have their kids learn, even when it's about those adult topics. You know, it's you can't go to a TV network and say, we want to make a show that's for adults and kids together, because then they're splitting their sort of like marketing,
Then advertising dollars.
The advertisers want to focus on one or the other. They don't want to split between two markets. But as a creator, I am so happy that it worked out that way.
Yeah, and I'm going to say, I do not want this to influence your content making in the slightest, because I definitely want you to be the person delivering the talk about sex and death, not me. So, like, keep it coming.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, no, that's a really nice way to put it, actually.
Well, they're going to have that. Yeah, I mean, we all know they're going to have that moment no matter what. So,
yeah,
it might as well come in the context of learning.
Yeah, and with some comedy that makes it go down more easily. I mean, comedy really, really helps. There's a George Carlin quote that I'm going to butcher, and I'll just paraphrase it. But it's from his book that he wrote before he died. And he wrote about how when someone is laughing, all of their defenses are down. And at that moment is when you can like plant a little seed of something new in them, and then that'll grow the rest of the time. Throughout the rest of their life. And so that approach is really what informed the rest of my career when I read that.
Right there is the end of this interview, right, Mom? Okay. All right.
We always know.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Except for one last thing.
Yeah. So we have a question we ask everybody who comes on this podcast, and it goes like this. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about?
Oh, man, I love this question. Well, we did an episode on wellness, right? The concept of wellness, which is usually by which we meant alternative medicine.
Yeah.
And I thought going in that, okay, we're going to do – this is going to be easy slam dunk episode. We're going to show how all these things, you know, Reiki healing and, you know, massages and essential oils and stuff like that, how it's all nonsense. And we're going to tell people, hey, go to traditional medicine and go to your doctor, right? And our big slam dunk for the end of that, I was gonna be on placebos and how the placebo effect is so much more powerful than you think it is. And that explains why so many of these things work. When you say, well, no, this really helps me. Hey, sorry, it's just the placebo effect. It's actually way more powerful than you think. And that's how it can do all the, that's why that alternative medicine seems to do all those incredible things. In the course of researching that segment and talking to, you know, there's these folks at Harvard at, I think it's called the Center for Placebo Studies. You know, these are indisputably the world experts on the study of placebos. We realized by talking to them about their work that the truth about the placebo effect is it is actually so powerful. It's a really valuable part of medical treatment. And in fact, it's used by that it's actually used in traditional medicine. When the doctor, you know, listens to you patiently and touches your, you know, the place where you hurt, you know, and gives you a medicine and says, this is really going to help, right? That is taking advantage of the placebo effect in exactly the same way as if you go see a, you know, Chinese traditional medicine practitioner. And that means that those alternative medicine procedures, as long as they're not doing any harm to you, some of them are harmful, but the majority are not. And as long as you're not ignoring traditional medicine, that can actually give you a real benefit. So our final takeaway from that episode ended up being, hey, use this stuff. If it's not hurting you and you're not neglecting, you know, science-based medical treatment, as long as you're still getting your cancer treated, hey, go get the sound healing if it reduces your pain. And that was really something I didn't expect. It was so wonderful and really validated the primary principles of our show, which is that we never know anything for sure. It's always worth questioning every belief that you have. And it's always a good thing when you find out that you were wrong. It happened to us in the course of producing that episode, which was incredibly rewarding.
I think there could not have. Oh, look, I blew the sting, man. There was, you know, they whispered in my ear, there's a sting coming, and I blew it.
It's new.
God, I hate that. Yeah, it's new. So look, here's what I think about that interview. I think there could not have been a more spot on what we are trying to do interview than that one right there, right? And I especially love the George Carlin thing. And I have to say, he must have really butchered that quote because I tried to look it up and I couldn't find it. But the idea that when somebody's laughing, their defenses are down, some corollary of that, even if it's close to what he said, is just cool because, I mean, people have to be willing to receive information. And that's, my God. Oh, here it is. Look, it's a connecting of the dots. If you go back to our fixation up at the top in the fixation fix, people have to be willing to receive information. Right. Mm-hmm. And the catch is, how do you prepare them and make them willing to receiving information? And one of the ways Adam does it is by humor. That's it. Sermon over.
And it was really interesting because he sort of downplayed that. Like he said, you know, there's these studies that show that people don't trust. And I was like, I don't think that's true. I think that John Stewart and John Oliver and, you know, Seth Meyers like and Samantha Bee are in fact the people that other people trust at this point, because you can, you know. I don't know. You don't go in so angry at a time when everybody's angry. So
I
was
right.
Like, don't sell yourself short, Adam. Like, I think you could actually fix everything right here.
Yep.
Or we can too. I mean, also us.
Also,
we'll just start doing like,
it's not all him, man. It's us.
More hilarious skits and stuff.
Just be funnier. All right. More ahead. First though, got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk, to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
And now it is time to hear from you.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
Hi, Al Groves from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I wanted to say a little bit about...
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
That's like my favorite part.
Yeah.
I also only ever want to talk about the totally different but maybe just like a little bit related thing. Also, I'd like to take it to the 100,000 foot level and make it hella philosophical. Yes. Would that be cool?
See, hella.
Okay. Hella. It's Oakland. Now you're just like,
you're stealing
Oakland.
My line, stealing your line.
I'm going to teach you Telegraph Avenue by Lloyd, a.k.a. Childish Gambino. Then you're going to have the Oakland song in your head all the time. Okay.
Anywho.
Back to the news and the feedback. So many of you had thoughts about our Nancy Lublin episode and data being used for good or something else. And in the context of data and the data economy that was sort of exploding all around us last week, I think we were appropriately called out. Like, we talked to her about data and how it is used, but I thought we were appropriately called out by Matthew Heston and others who said this nonprofit company, Crisis Text Line, is really, really important. But Matthew said he's really skeptical of the data company, Loris AI, because it uses such personal information. He thinks private data should be treated equally regardless of its end use. Here's Matthew.
If I went to my therapist this week and he said, I'm going to use our last year of conversations to help me make money by training United employees, I'd have so many questions, and I almost certainly wouldn't be cool with that. But having good intentions alone doesn't make the lightsaber blue.
First of all, oh snap, on the lightsaber thing. But he's right. Right? He's totally right.
He's absolutely totally right.
Yeah.
He's right. And I got a tweet to that effect while I was live tweeting all the congressional hearings, who said, wait a second, you're gonna come after Facebook, but when Nancy Lublin says it's a good intention, then you're like, oh, all right. You know what? Really, really good point.
So do you suppose it's like the scale of Facebook or the fact that Facebook has a history of playing fast and loose with data? What do we think it is that makes everybody go, Facebook is evil?
Well, I think it's definitely scale. I mean, yes, they have a history of playing fast and loose, and now the scale is such that we're looking at, you know, wait a second, what is the impact here? And so there was a great moment, actually, during those congressional hearings where the representative from Mississippi, whose name I can't remember, said, Congress is really good at doing two things, doing nothing and overreacting.
Right.
And he said, and we're about to overreact. Right. And I was like, yeah, society is about to overreact because data can be used for good.
Right.
In a lot of ways. And in fact, a lot of future solutions really do depend on data. And so hopefully companies like Facebook that play fast and loose and maybe break democracy won't like ruin it for the rest of us forever.
We are still getting lots of feedback, actually, on that whole Facebook segment and the hearings and all of this. If you remember last week, Lindsey Graham, senator of South Carolina, asked Zuckerberg whether Zuckerberg thinks Facebook is a monopoly. Zuckerberg said, it doesn't seem that way to me, Senator. But Meredith Askey from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, gave it some thought. And she says, Facebook followed basic economics, provided all the services we asked for under one platform. Here is Meredith in her own words.
We, the users of the internet, we, the market, are basically asking for one company to have a monopoly. We're demanding that. So what occurred to me is, oh my God, maybe this is where blockchain comes in. But until that happens, there's always going to be an AOL or a Facebook. Until there is some mechanism for us to maintain our own data and our own platform, and maybe the idea of blockchain is part of the answer. Discuss.
If this wasn't audio, I would throw up the laughing, crying emoji because, good idea, but explaining blockchain is pretty tricky. Molly Wood, go.
I am so obsessed with this. On the one hand, this could be considered a convergence of a lot of buzzwords, which it was when I texted a friend the other day and was like, hey, how do we make a startup where we create a blockchain-based solution that allows us to own our own data and parcel it out on a, you know, an internet transaction handshake basis? Okay. The thing, here's what blockchain is. It is a ledger. So it is a place on the internet where transactions get recorded. And can be conducted in a way that is not controlled by any one party and that anybody can look at. So blockchain is this giant, open, distributed ledger. And so no one controls it, like I said, and anybody can see what has happened. You can go back and look at the transaction history. So the theory is, among some privacy and blockchain enthusiasts, that your data could be stored in that way and you would control that page in the ledger, and you would be able to grant access as a series of electronic transactions that you approve. So your data would be totally encrypted as it passed, as it went around, like Bitcoin transactions are. And that you would ultimately be in control of it. It wouldn't just be some like wide open stream, you know, that people could come and like dip their cups into.
Take water out all the time. So my data package, as it were, right? That file that Facebook or Google or whoever it is has on me would piggyback on a blockchain chain?
Yeah, it would piggyback on blockchain technology. So you would build a new, you know, you would have to build in, there would be a new repository of your data that lived on top of blockchain technology. And one of the things people like about it is that it can conduct these transactions on a purely purely electronic basis. So like there's no middleman, there's no, you know, fuzziness. It's basically like if Facebook pays you 2 credits, then it can access your search history.
Huh.
And so what people like about it is that it's potentially an opportunity for us to get paid for our data, which is frankly what I think needs to start happening ASAP.
So here's what I think, actually, just thinking about how complicated that last 90 seconds of our lives was. I think we need to actually spend a little time.
I failed.
And no, you didn't, because I understand it, right? I mean, my information gets piggybacked on the blockchain. But I think it would be a good public service for us to do if we could do an actual explainer-ish thing on blockchain and privacy. Right. And whether that's you talking to somebody or me talking to somebody or us talking to somebody together and help people understand this, because ouch.
I think it'd be great. And it's becoming, people are really into this idea. Yeah. And I am not 100% certain yet of whether it's technically feasible or just a bunch of happy buzzwords. And so I think it'd be a great conversation to have.
And also, is blockchain like the savior of everything? Because pretty much any, you know, new dilemma that comes up with, that society comes up with, everybody's like, oh, blockchain will fix that. That can't
blockchain is the new AI. You heard it here first.
Anyway, what else we got?
If you put an AI on your blockchain, then you have it all.
Yeah.
On this question of data and your personal information and your profile, Harvey McClary sent us a voice memo wondering if we the people can actually deceive the almighty platform.
And I'm just wondering if I would go in and change my profile and answer questions to surveys unlike what I would answer, to basically just destroy the whole profile that I have so that Facebook really doesn't know who I am. It's sort of the devil in me, but I think it would be funny, and it would also be funny if more people did that, because then their data would not be accurate and it would be useless. So I'd be interested to hear what you think. Thanks.
Huh.
Yeah.
So
hope springs eternal.
I don't know if I have that kind of time, man.
Nobody has that kind of time. But also, B, you can only do that if then so for one thing, the profile is so historical, and then it is also based on so many things that you don't even know you're doing. That it could be, you know, you might go in and take a bunch of quizzes to say, oh, I'm totally like this. But then you would do a web search based on your real life, you know, or you would actually like a thing, or you would actually. So there would be the effort involved in maintaining the kind of false version of you is intense. But this is a good point, the place to point out, though, that these algorithms are not perfect. And that's part of the problem, is they're collecting a lot of data about you, but they don't necessarily think it's the same thing. In fact, I was talking to somebody the other day who I would describe as highly moderate, if not conservative leaning, who was like, yeah, no, Facebook apparently thinks I'm an ultra liberal woman. And it's like a fairly conservative straight man, you know? And so, so maybe you're already tricking it. Who knows?
Take some time, would you, if you've got the time. Don't mess with your Facebook profile, but let us know what you think of this little enterprise we're doing here. Go to Apple Podcasts, leave us a review, subscribe, tell your friends. And do all that good stuff so that we can get more people listening to what we do, because that would be cool.
Please do, and we will see you next week.
Please.
I beg you.
Let me just say, by the way, no singing this time on the way out. Not happening.
Oh, people really liked it.
No, that's not the response I got, but thank you very much. Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Mars, Christopher Olin, and senior producer Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music has been composed by Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez.
We'll continue to be composed.
I don't know whatever tense I was using there.
The executive, there was a imperfect, blue perfect. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves. The senior vice president, general manager, and grammar director is Deborah Clark.
There is somebody out there who will give us the grammar tutorial. You know that, right?
They will.
They totally will.
That's why we do this show.
I, for one, welcome it. That's all I'm saying.
Someone tweeted me and accused me in a very accusatory tone, accused me of having vocal chops.
Chops.
And of hiding where they came from. Wow. And I was like, I'm not sure what that means. But should I be mad?
J'accuse. I don't know.
J'accuse vocal chops.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.